Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
I think I am very excited and happy by the difference of the world and by how distinct every particular place is. I think that we kid ourselves while living in small bubbles that globalization and great levels of communication and a whole variety of things are erasing difference all around the world and are making everything homogenous. And I think the paradox of the whole talk in some ways was that that difference was highlighted by one thing, that we were taking around a single story written by someone 400 years ago, and that all of the people in all of these different and distinct situations could understand that story and could see a part of themselves and a part of their own society in that one story. And so that was a really enjoyable paradox, that we took one cultural artifact around, that a lot of people looked at it, and that they all found something in it. They all found a common understanding and a common humanity in it, while at the same time we were discovering just how different and how particular the world is.
There is nothing neither good or bad, but thinking makes it so. The iconic words of Shakespeare from Hamlet, Act 2, Scene 2. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's great to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, we're going to unpack the linguistic brilliance, the philosophical trills, a mysterious allure of Hamlet with Dominic Trumgoole, the former artistic director of the Globe Theatre, whose new book, Hamlet Globe to Globe, has just been published by Canongate, where Dominic writes, "For a play that is supposed to be one of literature's most meditative and philosophical, Hamlet has a fairly impressive body count. It's not quite in the Terminator class, but it's not a long way off Titus Andronicus either." Dominic goes on to write that Hamlet has not just shrunk space, it has also contracted time. It is part of the fabric that surrounds and sits within us. It has become in large part us. So who and what is Hamlet? And how does the play speak to the 21st century and all our woes?
Hello, my name is Dominic Trumgoole. I was the artistic director of the Globe from 2006 through to 2016. Prior to that, I'd worked extensively in the theatre, largely in the world of new plays and new writing, first at the Bush and at the Old Vic, then with the Oxford Stage Company. I've also written extensively in the past. At the Globe, we did a number of things. We were very expansionist and fast-growing as an organization. It's a young organization. So we put on an international festival. We built a new theater. We created a filming platform and a VOD platform for the films we made. And we did extensive touring nationally and internationally. And that climaxed in a two-year tour of Hamlet between the 450th anniversary of Shakespeare's birthday and the 400th anniversary of his death. That's between April 23rd, 2014 and April 23rd, 2016. And in that time, we toured Hamlet to every single country in the world, or as close as damn it, or as close as we could get it. After I left the Globe last April, one of the things I've done is I've sat down and written a book about that experience of touring Hamlet everywhere and what Hamlet has taught me about the world and what the world has taught me about Hamlet and what's arisen in the conversation between the two.
What a stunning read, Dominic. Unbelievably expansive, humane, philosophical. It's so many different things. I actually studied Hamlet on my Leaving Cert about 25 mm-hmm. years ago at least. And it's such a universal and it's such a powerful story. There's something for everybody in it. I might start with a big wide open question for you just to kick things off. What does Shakespeare teach us, and particularly Hamlet?
What does Shakespeare teach us? That's pretty enormous as a question. The automatic response is nothing, in that he doesn't aim to teach. In fact, he eschews teaching and avoids it as hard as he can. He doesn't really have a didactic or a moral purpose. His great purpose is to present life and to present as wide and as free-ranging a universe as he can, within which there are many moral quandaries, within which there are many philosophical problems, within which there are many ideological battles. I think what we take from
Shakespeare is very much up to who we are individually and where we come from. It's very different for me than it is for someone from Peru or someone from Taiwan. We all take a vast and distinct thing from it. So personally, I could say that I've learned what it is to be a human being in many ways from him. I've learned about things, grief, jealousy, sanity, love, dealings with ingratitude of others, all sorts of things you learn from Shakespeare before you learn them from life. I also said previously that Shakespeare is like sort of emotional gymnasium in that, you know, you may not know anything about love when you're young, but you read Romeo and Juliet or you hear the line, "Oh Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou Romeo?" And something about the big broad expanse within that line teaches you something about love. You may not know what jealousy is. You may not know it in your life, but you read Othello and you observe Othello and what happens to Othello and you discover things about jealousy before you meet it in real life. So in some funny way, for me growing up, Shakespeare was a way of rehearsing emotions and rehearsing feelings and rehearsing stuff that I would be going through before I got to it in reality. And I think he's still doing that.
Halfway through the book, you say something on the lines of that the play Hamlet started to make you see the world through its own perspective. I thought that was fascinating. Can you talk me through that?
I think that one of the many striking things about it was that before I did the tour, I thought that Hamlet was about discovering calm and Hamlet was about discovering peace and about a young man who was troubled finding his way to a sort of harmony and a sort of oneness with where he was in the world. And I think that less and less. And I think that the tour taught me that Hamlet is about change and it's about restlessness and it's about wanting to make things different and it's about wanting to create a new modern and wanting to create a different future. I think that wherever we went, that's what people identified with it. People who knew the play well, people who didn't know the play well at all. Is the first thing they saw was a figure of authority, Claudius, and then at the same time, a figure of resistance, Hamlet, and they saw Hamlet bucking against everything that the figure of authority said and did and represented. And they didn't know what he was looking for. I don't think we all do know what Hamlet is looking for exactly, but we know that he wants change and he wants things to move and to shift. And I think that you started to see in the play's restlessness a reflection in some way of the world's restlessness and vice versa.
It offers no easy answers either. There's no quick solution. Sure, there's not.
No, it doesn't offer up any sort of little pat morals. It challenges and it challenges and it challenges. At the end, Hamlet says stuff that you could interpret as being sort of Zen Buddhist calm. If it be now, it's not to come. There's a special providence in the fall of a sparrow. You could say that that's him finding a sort of glorious acceptance. But then around him saying that, you see his wild flare of temper when he jumps into the grave of Ophelia and screams insanely at Laertes. You see him getting drawn into a trap based on his own vanity by a sort of gadfly, Osric. You see him lose his temper in the course of the fight with Laertes. So I think the old notion that it's a sort of Christian parable about somebody refining their own soul and a state of sweetness and repose, I think is something that isn't the whole of the story.
You write, everyone's definition of a good actor is different and that a good actor is hard to define. So when in all of that, how difficult was it casting Hamlet and the different characters?
We had a number of considerations when we were casting because we wanted to cast good actors, we wanted to cast good storytellers. We needed to cast people that were going to be adaptable and versatile, that could play in a stadium in Khartoum in front of 4,000 Sudanese in a sort of rock arena, that could play in a small studio theatre in Taiwan, that could play in a beautiful Spanish classical opera theatre in Lima in Peru, that could easily move between one and the other auditorium. So they had to be flexible and loose and capable of reacting to different situations as actors and as artists. But also we were very concerned about them as people, because it was going to be a huge and challenging human experience. And we needed people who would look after each other and be loyal to each other, who'd be fun, who'd be careful with themselves and of each other, and who were tough and tough enough to get from the beginning to the end. So I described it as trying to find astronauts, trying to find, you know, people for the space program almost, which is a sort of exaggeration. But we did want exceptional people. And then we were lucky that we found exceptional people.
Yeah, you write somewhere that a good actor, above all, must be kind. And that's not something that anyone would immediately think of. But then when you pare it all back or strip it all back, you're looking at teamwork, you're looking at friendship, you're looking at trust and loyalty, and a lot of high-flung emotions on stage, aren't you?
You are, yes. You need absolute loyalty. I always think that no one really quite understands the degree of ingrained discipline in an actor. You know, it's not an explicit discipline. It doesn't involve people blowing whistles or shouting or banging a drum. It's something that's got to be inside them because, you know, the convention that everybody is there at a certain moment, be it 7:30, and everybody is ready for the next 2.5 hours to all stay in a certain pattern, not rigidly, but sufficiently that the others can do what they do, requires an extraordinary amount of ingrained discipline, much greater than in any soldier, much greater than in any other profession that I can imagine. So that's a sort of given. And then above and beyond that, which within that, there's contained an enormous amount of questions about trust and about loyalty and about looking after other people. Part of the discipline is an act of kindness in that you follow the discipline, you follow the etiquettes of the stage as a way of looking after your fellow artists. But also, you want people around that arena of the stage to be kind to each other, because what people do is, you know, you risk your own dignity, you are exposing your own sensibility, you're exposing your own emotion, you're putting yourself on display, and you don't want that risk to be surrounded with cruelty or with viciousness or with small-mindedness. So you do want the actors to be intensely disciplined, generous, loyal on stage, and kind, generous and loyal offstage. Now, that might all sound a bit sort of lovey-ish and a bit darling-ish, but it's a sort of given that that's the world in which we have to work if we're going to be able to do what we do.
Hamlet offers so many iconic lines in cultural or theatre history, and there's so many ways that you can read to be or not to be, or what a piece of work is man, and all those famous reference points. But you argue that it's one of the most misconceived or misunderstood plays in performance history, and I was really surprised by that.
I think that it's taken a collection of skews over the centuries. It's sort of zigged and it's zagged according to whatever the prevailing intellectual fashion of the day is. I mean, it's the nature of an icon like that, is that it attracts strong interpretation, and every age wants to sort of claim it for its own. If I had to sort of categorize what's happened to it recently, I'd say that it's been sort of fetlocked by neurosis and imprisoned by angst and by post-Freudian interpretation and by concentrating on the hysteria of the central character himself, or characterising it as hysteria, which I don't think it is. And I watched a very, very good, lovely bit of old-fashioned television a while ago. It was Peter O'Toole and Orson Welles and an old English actor. I can't remember his name. I think it was Ernest Jones. And it's 1960s TV, and they're drinking whiskey and they're smoking cigarettes and they're giggling and they're ridiculing each other. And it's very, very entertaining and it's very funny. And O'Toole is very badly behaved and starts talking about Gertrude as a lesbian with absolutely no historical justification and not much textual justification. And that gives Orson Welles the giggle. So it's fun. But then in the middle of it, Orson Welles, as he, you know, almost always did, affords one sort of stunning insight and one incredible illumination, which is to say that Hamlet isn't a neurotic or a tortured soul or just those things. He is partly those things, but what he is principally is he's a genius, and he's a Mozartian prodigal genius of language. He gives language away with a generosity and an exuberance and abundance that no one else has ever matched. And, you know, Othello is a black man in a white man's world. The Scottish general is a soldier bordering on levels of pathology. King Lear is a sort of tyrant locked in his own fear of his own dementia. You know, those are their key notes from which the play emerges. And Hamlet's key note, in a way, is that he's a genius. He's a generous soul. He spills language out and insight out in an incredible way. And we know from his relationships with Rosencrantz Guildenstern, with Horatio, with Laertes, all the evidence we have of what he was before the house fell in on him and his father died, is that he was a great friend and a great joy and a great delight to be with. So that was one of the large sort of interpretive shifts that I wanted to make, is to bring it back a little bit of the sort of extraordinary, prodigious Renaissance prince.
I'm just wondering, Dominic, you spent so much time with Hamlet and with Shakespeare. What really is Hamlet all about? Because in one way we could say it's a play about love. In another way, you could argue it's a play about madness. And in another way, it's about grief. So I'm sure to every reader or to anyone who goes to a performance of Hamlet, depending on, you know, a director's production values and so on, that it can be understood in so many different ways, or it can give comfort in so many different ways.
I think that's exactly right. I think that it's about all those things that you mentioned, about love and about grief and about madness. And really, you can go to it depending on where you are in your life at that given moment. It might be that you are a young person troubled by the moral authority of your elders. It could be that you're somebody who's in love or fallen out of love, and falling out of love has sort of slightly endangered your identity or your sanity. It could be that you are morally troubled and you're trying to sort of reconfigure your understanding of the world. Or it could be that you're in pain about the loss of a parent, which is something that we all feel acutely. And whichever one of those it is, or many others, you can take to the play and you can find something rich and rewarding coming back from it. I think that's another of the essences about why this play is so great and Shakespeare is so great, is that it's multifaceted and it depends on where you're coming from when you arrive at the play, what you take away from it.
You write that touring Hamlet kept you honest in some way. It kind of took you down a peg or two on none of the, I suppose, the self-importance of big institutional settings. Can you talk to me about some of the big kind of lessons within all of that? I know Mexico was a very tough experience for the whole crew because he had food poisoning. In other places, it was just the actual logistics of where you were going to stage the show. So can you talk me through some of that?
Well, it's something that we developed over the course of time with our touring program. We created a small-scale touring program that we took around. And it was very important for us as a way of sort of consciously giving away our dignity, not just risking it, but sort of freely spending it and throwing it away almost, in that, big institutions, cultural institutions, can very quickly become grand. And everyone within them can become grand and can become divorced from their audience and also divorced from the process of making. But the great thing about the Globe is that on the one hand, you know, we had this immense edifice on the South Bank in London. And we were playing to extraordinary audiences and, enjoying a burgeoning reputation in the sort of eyes of the world. But on the other hand, you know, everyone was going around with these small-scale tours, and if you were there, you had to put the seats out for the audience or do a bit of front of house or help putting the set up or at the end of the show get a power drill out and take all of the bolts out of the structure that made the set and help pack things away. So everybody had to be hands-on and everyone had to get the dirt under their fingernails. And that keeps people from being too self-important and too divorced from the process of making, which was very, very important to me in terms of who we are as an organization in the eyes of the world, but also how the people that work there understood who they were. Because it's very, very easy for any institution to get airs and graces and to start becoming other. And I was very keen that the Globe didn't. And so this tour in particular, and the process of touring, were very good ways of avoiding that.
I'd say Djibouti was interesting, was it?
Oh, yeah, it's fascinating. Yeah, no, it's a fascinating place. I mean, it's tiny. Well, it's a small little scrap of earth locked between places that have been trapped in difficult political and social situations for the last 100-odd years, between Eritrea and Ethiopia and Somalia. And it's got an incredible pile-up of international interest. The only American naval base on African soil is there. The French, who were the sort of colonial masters, still have a big military interest there. The Chinese are showing a great deal of fascination. All of the countries of the world park their sort of special forces there so that they can jump on big ships and escort them up and down the Red Sea to avoid pirates. So you get this incredible blend of geopolitical shifting movement and a small little scrap of earth. And so it was quite a brutal introduction to the realpolitik of the world.
I said a fire to the moon shade. You're just shadows in the cascade of history. Faded love and then your gaze. The sky relieves. I said our bodies are my longshore. This heavy whisper makes me more scared than anything. I was loved and now they're lost, lost. I know they'll never find us. Way out of mix of madness, I feel free in time. Four depths with me, miles apart in light. We solve our whole lives in time. You've reached the brighter part of life. We fall. You pry me thumping from this long draw. My twisted body in a bind that you want to break. This house is covered by your blood spot. Don't give a fuck what's taken. I hear there's wars worth making. I just leave in time. Four depths with me, miles apart in light. We solve our whole lives in time. The brighter parts of life. So take all our lips, all our mumbles, they are fable. Bind it all up and cast it all out into the light. I sense all your own, see all your own, and you are able. We drop from the sky, fill our lungs to feel alive. In time. Steps with me, miles apart in light. We solve our whole lives in time. You've reached the brighter part of life.
On Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's great to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, we're unpacking the psychological depths and creative magic of Shakespeare's Hamlet with Dominic Drumgoole, the former artistic director of the Globe Theatre in London, whose new book, Hamlet Globe to Globe, has just been published by Canongate, where Dominic writes, "If there is one thing that Hamlet has not been since his first death in 1601 is silent. He may die in one place, but he springs back to life instantaneously somewhere else. Hamlet is there to make things uncertain and less easy, to scuff up a little trouble in the world." I asked Dominic about Shakespeare's skillful use of rhetoric in Hamlet and other plays. Dominic writes, "Rhetoric is often thought of a way of freezing thought, whereas it's actually a way of creating it." I put it to Dominic whether rhetoric is received differently in various cultural spaces and locations.
Yeah, we never quite knew what would go and what would go large and what would go small and what people would take to in certain ways and what people would not absorb so much. We had a variety of people's comprehension wherever we were because we didn't always have the technology to set up subtitles extensively because we were moving at such speed. And some people knew the plays inside out, upside down, and back to front, and better than we did. Some people didn't know them so well. So within the audience, you'd have a different degree of what people were taking in from it. Some people just took in, you know, the strong physical story and the relationships and the patterns of the relationships, and delighted in that and read that as they would. Some people were, you know, way up to speed with the rhetoric of it and asking very big and important questions. But for us, it was just about presenting it with as much clarity and buoyancy as possible, and leaving the interpretation to the audience. We don't like to sort of presuppose what that interpretation should be by putting a big slant across it.
A student came up to you in Phnom Penh in the capital of Cambodia and said something on the lines of, "What can the play mean to us now?"
Yeah.
And I thought that was must have been unbelievably humbling for you to somebody to pitch up a question like that and in a lot of ways speak so directly.
Yeah, it's flattening because you suddenly realise how powerful and deep the hunger is for what we were presenting, to give them a sense of meaning and to give them a sense of clarity about an enormous amount of very difficult questions that don't all naturally occur to us where we come from. When we arrived in Phnom Penh, we went to the theatre and there was a technician standing beside the poster, and the poster was a picture of Hamlet holding a skull. And the technician turned to us and said, "Oh, is this a play about the Khmer Rouge?" Because obviously skulls are an enormous part of the iconography of that culture. They're sort of, the capital city, Phnom Penh, is surrounded by fields of skulls. And so for them, it seemed, that just that image seemed very vital and relevant. And I spoke to a group of students and they were all very earnestly on the attack, saying, "What does this mean to us now? What does this mean to Cambodia now? What can it give us?" And you have to be careful when you're answering questions like that, because it would be grotesquely presumptuous to say, "Oh, it's going to make this easier for you or that easier for you, or it's going to settle this or solve that." You have to say, you know, the play is the play and it's there to provoke thought and maybe, if it's lucky, give a little bit of understanding and convey vitality and convey the excitement of telling a story of that like that, and the excitement of asking those questions, rather than saying, "Oh, it's going to give you this great moral truism, which is going to clean up all of your mess," which it's incapable of doing.
And when you think, Dominic, that over 2 million people were murdered, savagely murdered by the Khmer Rouge, and I think you mentioned that 90% of artists in Cambodia at the time of the Khmer Rouge were murdered. It's impossible to get your head around that, isn't it?
It is, yeah. There was a deliberate attempt to sort of purge the society of what were deemed artists and intellectuals and creative people, and they were a terrifyingly, ruthlessly doctrinaire bunch. And the degree of devastation that they caused to the human community was staggering, and to the cultural and imaginative and intellectual life of that community was staggering. And you know, we encountered a group there after doing the show who one of the members of the company had a connection to, who were there, you know, doing their utmost under the guidance of an old master of Cambodian music who managed to survive that regime and all of the problems that ensued, and he is now trying to rebuild painstakingly, from documentary evidence, from film, from recordings, a whole variety of traditions of music and of dance and, you know, dramatic art, just to try and put back in place what was once a very thriving culture. And they see that as an enormously key part of how you rebuild a society and how you rebuild a society that's been devastated by conflict and by violence. And I think, you know, that was one of many ways in which we sensed, you know, how vital culture can be.
You write wonderfully about Quito in Ecuador and Lima in Peru, and you say something something on the lines of, "All that matters is a sum of happiness and that you increase it however way you're able to." I thought that was beautiful. And in a lot of ways, it's also very idealistic. But isn't that what true art is about? It's about those idealistic values and hope and courage within it.
It is, I think. Yeah, I think that, yes. I think that, you know, you're bashed, like on a big tour like that, you're bashed like a shuttlecock backwards and forwards from places of horrendous deprivation and pain and loss to places that are fat and overfed and make fun of themselves, like the UK, for want of a better expression. And then places of sort of, you know, on one level, extreme joy and delight and energy and vibrancy and colour. And, you know, we were all a bit entranced by various countries in South America, and particularly by that small run of, we had of Colombia and Ecuador and Peru. And I'm sure that the society is infinitely complex and it's full of problems, and I wouldn't want to simplify it, but you also, you know, take a sum of joy out of those places, which is very hard to equal from anywhere else. And I think, you know, when you're shuttling between all of those different places, you know, you start to worry about how you react to such different situations, where in one place there's grinding poverty or imposed uniformity, and in another place there's just this wild joy. And whether you should change your attitude and whether you should rearrange what you're giving them. And it was an insight that came, thankfully, unbidden in South America, was that, you know, what matters is increasing it, increasing joy and increasing security and increasing vitality wherever you are. And if you're making a happy place happier, that's great. And if you're trying your best to give some element of belonging or security to a place that's lacking in it, that's great as well. What matters is that you're adding and that you're building and that you're not subtracting or destroying.
I was very interested in what you wrote about Sitari refugee camp, and you described the brokenness all around and the devastation and the poverty. But within all of that, you also say that it was very kind of a normal place as well, and that it was surprisingly normal in terms of the ebb and flow of life. Did that shock you and some of the actors? Or were you prepared for that, to maybe to get your world turned upside down and back over again?
Well, I think there are lots of things about Sitari which are just plain obscene. And probably foremost among those is the size of it, is that it's not really a camp, it's a city. It's a city of about 120,000 people. And for that many people to be living in a temporary way without a sense of home or without a sense of location is obscene. The uniformity of it is obscene. They're all in white prefab sort of boxes, side by side by side by side by side. And although they're sort of dressing them and making them seem and personalizing them in you know, ways that any of us would, it's still terrifying to be all in boxes in the middle of the desert like that. The fact that it's hidden away from sight by sort of earth mounds all around, so that the world isn't sort of aware it's there, is obscene. All of those things are, you know, deeply distressing and very depressing. But humanity has an incredible capacity of normalizing and of reasserting itself and of recreating its own structures and its own comedies and its own pettinesses and its own ways. And so it was striking, and it was, you know, tribute to the people that were there, that within this sort of obscene framework, we arrived on a Sunday morning, and there were elements of it that felt like a Sunday morning. There were people walking to social gatherings. There were small kids tumbling around making trouble. There were bigger kids charging around on bikes. There were gatherings of men and gatherings of women here and there. And, you know, there was laughter there. Now, that is in no way an attempt to gloss over the hideousness of the existence of that place. It's simply a tribute to the people that were there, and in many ways to the human spirit generally, that we have this incredible capacity to cope. Now, we shouldn't be coping, but it was touching, and it just increased our admiration for the people that were there, that they were coping.
Dominic, you pitch up an extraordinary question in the book. You ask whether Hamlet could be a woman. I'm just wondering, as you played out Hamlet in different locations throughout the world, and obviously you've different types of actors, and I imagine on some days somebody gets sick and somebody has to fill a vacancy and so on. Could it be argued that Hamlet could have been a woman? Like, do you think we've a very kind of overly fixed perspective on the gender of Hamlet? I know somewhere that you write that Hamlet lives in the fog, and, you know, that he's not very clear, and he's this kind of the idea of liminality.
Yeah, well, I mean, there was a great and huge and honourable tradition of women playing Hamlet across the world through to the beginning, through to about the 1920s of the last century, in that we know that women started playing Hamlet towards the end of the 17th century, and then it grew and grew and grew as an event, and there were various, you know, recorded pioneering performers in the UK and especially in America who played Hamlet women, including extraordinarily in the Wild West. Certain actresses went over and played Hamlet there, which is just sort of such a vivid image, and I've never quite got it out of my head. And that obviously climaxed with Sarah Bernhardt doing a sort of legendary Hamlet through the 1880s, the 1890s and 1900s, which was the sort of definitive performance almost of Hamlet for that time. And then an incredible film made and started by Danish actress Asta Nielsen, in which she played Hamlet and then gave an interpretation of Hamlet as a woman from birth whose gender has been disguised by her parents. And they were both very remarkable and very brilliant artistic understandings of the play. And the fact they were there and the fact they were possible is because of this extraordinary, as you say, liminality of what Hamlet is that he's not decidedly one thing or another. He's dissatisfied with himself. He's dissatisfied that he's not more of a decisive, action-taking, masculine figure. He sort of berates himself for it. There's a whole collection of other things that he's unhappy that he's not as much something as he'd like to be. And so out of those sort of failures to be anything, he creates a lot of room for maneuver for what he could be. And essentially, he becomes a sort of essence of all of our more insecure, uncertain selves. And because of that, it's a sort of rather absurd thing to say that he could only be played by any one sort of person, or he could only be played definitively by any one sort of person.
Yeah, but if you look at a play and try and find all these definitives, well, in a lot of ways, you're missing the beauty, maybe, and the ideas within the play. Like, I think it could be argued that whether audiences, wherever they are, whatever location in the world, whether they understand all the true meanings within Hamlet and all the different layers and contexts, they will relate in some way to that sense of dissatisfaction and that anger, or whether it's grief or whatever it is, and bring it back and understand it through their own experiences, won't they?
Well, yeah, I think that's absolutely right, is that it's about somebody who wants more or wants different. Mm. Now, what that more is and what that different is very, very open to understanding or to interpretation. But wanting more, wanting different, wanting change is something that everybody knows. I recount in the book an experience when we went to Saudi Arabia, to a university in Saudi Arabia. We played to an audience of men and women, and we had men and women on stage. And both of that, those things took a lot of negotiation because they told us it hadn't previously been done in Saudi. I wasn't quite sure if that was true or not, but they told us that. So in some ways, it was a breakthrough. And afterwards, later in the evening, I had a chat with three young students who were very high and very enlivened in their ability to think and their ability to question. And I chatted to them about, you know, what they got from it. And they were saying that they got that. They got dissatisfaction. They got hunger. They got desire for change. They got a sense of political rage without really understanding quite what it defined. But they knew it was there. And it was that that enlivened them and made them think about their own lives and their own quest for difference and their own quest for change, which is obviously quite acute in Saudi Arabia.
As a matter of interest, what's your favourite soliloquy?
No favourites.
No favourites?
No favourites. No, that's the rule in Shakespeare world for me, is that I'm a great believer that you can't have favourites in anything if you're involved in Shakespeare world, and that you have to take everything on a totally favoured nations basis, whether it's a character or a speech or a line or a play or a experience or a country you visit or a person you meet or whatever. Just enjoy and celebrate variety. Don't try and create hierarchies.
Do you think it could be argued in some way that history has changed Hamlet? I know that you mentioned that we have three texts of Hamlet, and that so that there's no definitive text as such, and that Shakespeare, which I was very surprised to read, he never supervised the printing of his own plays, which really just shows you just how confident he was. Or maybe naive in another way. You could read it in lots of different ways. But I do think there was a lot of confidence to be able to not have to supervise everything.
I don't think it was confidence. I seriously don't think he thought of his plays and posterity. He did prepare his poems for publication. He did prepare his sonnets for publication, and he dedicated in front of them. And so we know that there was a seriousness there and a gravity about what they were and what they'd do in the world. But the plays, no. I think that he thought the plays were ephemeral, and they were for the moment they were in, and they were for the audience, and that the theatre was such a sort of impure form in itself that to sort of insist on a perfect publicating process would be a bit daft. Yeah, but, you know, as a distinction, Ben Jonson, who printed a folio of his plays in 1616, we know was very involved in the publication and was very involved in making sure that the texts were sort of authoritative, and Shakespeare wasn't.
What do you make of Shakespeare's theology? Because he was operating or writing at a time when England was under a lot of religious tensions, or experiencing a lot of religious tensions between Protestants and Catholics, and there was tensions in his own family background. But within that, is there, how do you understand the kind of the, I suppose, possible Christian messages within Hamlet and some other of the plays? Ideas of redemption, transformation, forgiveness. Because you get a lot of that, or questions around that in Hamlet.
I think you do, but I think it's wrong to see it as the mainspring of the play or the source of the play. I think that Christianity floats through Hamlet and occurs within Hamlet, and, you know, it is important. But to say that it's the heart of the play or the centre of the play would be an exaggeration of a world where we see Claudius using Christianity at some moments expediently, at other moments with great earnestness, where we see a play that revolves around family dynamics, where we see a social situation that's defined by political struggle, where we see geopolitical situation where people are sort of bashing each other just for land and territory. The landscape and the universe it's within is not one that seems to be animated by a very active god or deity. So there is Christianity there as a way of understanding the self, as a way of understanding the movements of the self and how we make our way through life. But to say it's the whole of the world they live in would be a bit daft. And I think that's true of Shakespeare. And, you know, Shakespeare was writing at this moment, of incredible tension between two different diverse forms of understanding of Christianity and, you know, a fair amount of people around him who had given up on all forms of religious life. And so it was one of the same moment, a place where religion was incredibly rich and important, and also where people could sort of see beyond it and see that it was only a small part of the bigger world.
You write about different performances and you say something on the lines of the telling is an act of connection. I'm just wondering, what was the toughest gig for you on a personal level? Moving aside from all the kind of logistics and, you know, staging and some of the more kind of typical stuff, what maybe confounded you the most?
London, probably.
For what reason?
It's tough. You design something for the world, and you find a home in the world, and it really was a well-made artifact for the world. It travelled, it was modest, it was what it was, and people accepted it as that. And London, you know, theatre scene is pretty ghastly in lots of ways, and it's full of meretriciousness and phonyism and hypocrisy and false standards and people, you know, out to kvetch. And so in some ways that's the hardest place to play. And the sort of curiosity and intellectual excitement that you find somewhere else, it's quite hard to find in London. So I'd say London is the toughest of all gigs.
Has both writing Hamlet globe to globe and obviously staging Hamlet in so many ambitious and intriguing locations, has it changed your own perspective on the world, I wonder? Because how you write about certain locations, you write very passionately, very emotively, in some places very politically charged. So I imagine it has changed your whole perspective on life in one way.
Yes. Yes, it's a lot less simpler world than I thought. That's a sort of stupid thing to say, but it's the truth. And I think I am very excited and happy by the difference of the world and by how distinct every particular place is. I think that we kid ourselves while living in small bubbles that globalization and great levels of communication and a whole variety of things are erasing difference all around the world and are making everything homogenous. My experience from my travels, and I didn't go to as many places as the company, of course, but my experience were, you know, that no, difference is still difference, that, you know, cheese does taste different in France. A pisco sour is the only thing to drink in Peru. That goat, you know, a lemony goat dish is better in Somalia than it is anywhere else in the world. And that, you know, the people and their culture and the language and the landscape and the climate and the history and everything, that those differences are still vital and strong. I think that's very fortifying. I'm delighted by difference. And I think the paradox of the whole tour in some ways was that that difference was highlighted by one thing, that we were taking around a single story written by someone 400 years ago, and that all of the people in all of these different and distinct situations could understand that story and could see a part of themselves and a part of their own society in that one story. And so that was a, you know, a really enjoyable paradox, that we took one cultural artifact around, that a lot of people looked at it, and that they all found something in it. They all found a common understanding and a common humanity in it, while at the same time we were discovering just how different and how particular the world is.
And what about improvisation?
In terms of how we presented the show?
In terms of how the word, what the word meant to you afterwards, because you did an incredible amount of improvisation.
Oh, no, that's, you know, that's written into the core of what the Globe is, certainly, is that you can't create shows that are sort of freeze-dried and locked down, that everything you do has got to be capable of reacting to a gust of wind or a plane moving above or a loud noise going off somewhere else, that you've got to be as flexible as possible.
And that was British producer, theatre director and writer Dominic Drumgoole. Hamlet Globe to Globe is published by Canongate and is available in all good bookshops for just under €20 in hardback. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Okay, all that's left for me to do now is to say a big thank you to Ronan Brannock, who helped out with this week's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been Talking Books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with the perceptive words of Dominic Drumgoole from Hamlet Globe to Globe. Hamlet is less about moral choice than the summoning of willpower. Interesting take indeed. Good night.
And suffer the sight when you walked out in rage and order. An offer that stayed. What use in the white endless sight in the eye? Oh, sorrow's here to warn you. In this order seems hard to leave. I hold at the breach. I've got my reason. In this order seems hard to leave, I hold at the breach. I've got my reason. I wake to your likeness, but how come you're here? I wasn't found and delayed. It's the call before it's far from more. My temples are hearts, and then heaven I leave. Heavy the final force, and I was down and out in order. And I was down in this odyssey. It's hard to leave, I hold at the breach. I've got my seats, hard to leave.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.